As many of our listeners know, Dr. David Feliciano sadly passed away in January 2024. To honor his memory, we re-uploaded two of our interviews with Dr. Feliciano, as well as a tribute with some of our thoughts on the passing of this legend of trauma surgery and a great mentor and teacher.
Welcome to Cold Steel, the Canadian Journal of Surgery podcast with your hosts Amir Farouk and Chad Ball. The goal of the CJS podcast is threefold. The first is to highlight the best research currently being completed by Canadian surgeons. The second is to offer educational topics for both surgeons and trainees alike. And most importantly, the third goal is to inspire discussion, thoughts, creativity, and career development in all Canadian surgeons. We hope you enjoy it.
It's not an understatement to say that Dr. David Feliciano is a true giant in trauma surgery. He literally wrote the textbook on trauma, now in its 8th edition. In this episode, Dr. Feliciano gives us his insights on leadership, recruiting star faculty, research, and the future of trauma. Check out all the show notes for links to papers we discuss in the show.
Well, Dr. Feliciano, thank you very much for spending your time and meeting with us on Cold Steel, our podcast. We really, 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 truly do thank you for it. We know how busy you are and how crazy the world is right now, and it's amazing to have an icon on Cold Steel like yourself. I guess our first question out of the gate is, all of our listeners, of course, know who you are, but few of them know you. So we're just curious where you grew up and what took you down the pathway towards medicine.
I was born in New York City, grew up briefly there, and then when my dad left for World War II, my mother moved to northern New Jersey, about 15 miles from New York City, because that's where my father's large Italian family was stationed. So I grew up there. My interest in medicine was almost completely due to my father, who was a community surgeon. Again, in a city of about 25,000 people and almost exactly 15 miles from New York City, I rounded with him when I was 5 years old as a start. And he later had me working, doing urinalysis in the lab on Saturday mornings.
Wow.
When I was in high school. And then, of course, I got my first job as an operating room technician in my father's hospital, and then spent a total of 5 summers working at hospitals in the New York, New Jersey area as a technician. So I had a lot of exposure to medicine. And secondly, my dad was one of these even-keeled, likable human beings who was really revered in our town. He was the Board of Education doctor, the Board of Health doctor, the industrial consultant, did all the physicals for all the high school athletes. So I was kind of really immersed in medicine from a young age, frankly. I owe it all to my dad.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, that immersion is probably the right word. Did you ever consider doing anything else at any point?
No, it was always medicine or science. But one of my vivid memories is when I was filling out my college paperwork to go to Georgetown in Washington, D.C., there was a line you had to fill in, which was, what is your projected major? And my father was sitting next to me at our home in northern Jersey. And I turned to him and I said, well, what should I put? He said, well, you put biology because that's pre-med. So that was a very short discussion.
Short and direct, eh? Can you tell us about your training pathway through medical school and then all the way through the end of your training?
Briefly, I really wanted to stay at Georgetown for residency. But my father, who was a Georgetown graduate, class of 39, was really opposed to that, and he thought I ought to get out and see other academic centers in the country. I found out that the Mayo Clinic was now accepting interns. They had previously only accepted residents, and I eventually matched at Mayo for my surgical residency. The thing that struck me when I interviewed at Mayo was that they did 120 cases in the operating room in one day in their two hospitals when I interviewed. And it looked to me like they did more cases in one day than Georgetown University Hospital did in several weeks. There was also a large variety of cases and a lot of high-end cases. So I discussed it again with my dad, and that was my first choice, and I matched there. And you know, I'm eternally grateful for his advice and for the training I had at the Mayo Clinic. I went to Houston right after that to do what in those days was a vascular fellowship. And that came about because I wanted to go on staff at the county hospital in Houston, now called Ben Taub Hospital. But Dr. DeBakey and the faculty at Baylor College of Medicine said, well, I couldn't go on faculty unless I took either cardiac or vascular training because everyone, in quotes, had that kind of training there. So I started, I did a six-month vascular fellowship, all of it on Dr. DeBakey's service, and then became an attending at the county hospital after that 6 months. When I got interested in trauma, it appeared that I might need some more training. So I took a leave of absence from my residency at the Mayo Clinic and eventually spent, you know, my time as a trauma fellow in Detroit with Charlie Lucas and Anna Ledgerwood. So I've trained in a few different places, and I've trained with some really good people, obviously DeBakey and his colleagues in Houston, and Ken Maddox in Houston, and Charlie Lucas and Anna for trauma in Detroit. I really encourage people to not be afraid to take a look at places that perhaps wouldn't fit their mold, but be aware that places with huge volumes and lots of experience can teach you a lot.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, your training and mentor list is sort of the hit list of that, you know, that 1.0 generation of trauma surgeons. It's remarkable. You clearly, you know, I would say, at least from the outside, made your name at Ben Taub in Houston with your partners Birch and Maddox, and then moved on to Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, where I think, you know, I think it's really honestly safe to say took it to a whole new level, and I would say iconic. What was it like walking into Grady Memorial Hospital, given the history and the weight of that place, initially led by Harlan Stone, and of course then you? How did you feel, and how was that experience?
I really campaigned actively to become a surgeon in chief at Grady. My predecessor, the late Roger Sherman, was nearing the end of his time there, and it looked like a perfect place for me. I would be in a leadership position. I would still have a huge volume of general trauma and vascular surgery, and I would be affiliated with a nice private university, i.e. Emory. When I got there and I was aware of some of the issues, they had really not had a very large number of full-time faculty there. A lot of the faculty historically rotated down from Emory University Hospital to help cover. There were no attendings in-house at night. Many of the cases during the day were performed by senior residents without supervision. The three things I really tried to change quickly. One, we took back the trauma resuscitations from emergency medicine. We got a stat page system. The attendings had to answer, and later the fellows. So we quickly reestablished ourselves as the trauma resuscitation team. Secondly, we did not have an ICU service when I got there, and eventually all the partners in our group were double boarded. So we had a surgical intensivist in place every day, and then eventually a full-time surgical critical care service that the fellows, residents, and students could rotate through. And then I think the biggest decision was I told the faculty they would have to come in at night on every case, but I did not in the beginning mandate that they had to sleep in. And I'd sort of learned some lessons from watching other leaders. And about 9 months later, I said to the faculty, aren't you tired of coming in at night? Why don't we just sleep here? It'll be a lot easier. And interestingly enough, nobody objected. And it really, really changed, I think, the hospital's perception of our group, that we were really committed to taking care of the patients. Because remember, we weren't getting paid for night call in those days. We just slept in of our own volition.
Wow. Well, you've certainly trained a lot of Canadians, and you know the three of us that come to mind would be
right.
you know in order, Lorraine Tremblay in Toronto, Neil Perry in London, and myself here in Calgary. And we all talk about it, you know, the institution of Grady and Emory, and of course you guys as a group, as being a really unnatural, almost like beyond superstar, like a truly globally impressive group of faculty that we got to interact with. And I realize parts, you know, change here and there, but I'm curious, how did you create that group up front, and what do you, like, in terms of leadership style, how do you get there? How did you do that?
I think you have to be very honest when you're recruiting people. So when we sent out a call for people to apply for faculty from time to time, we didn't gloss over the problems. We reminded people this was a public hospital, that salaries were sort of restricted to AAMC levels for academic rank, that night call was unpaid. And then we told them the positives, that there was a huge volume of general trauma, vascular, intensive care for them to work on and to study. We told them the Emory residency was elite, with a lot of great residents at the time spending 35-40% of their 5 years at Grady. And then after interviewing people who we felt were really interested in coming, we always met as a group to see if the other partners thought the new person would fit in or not. It's very interesting. We had several occasions where we had highly qualified candidates who just didn't appeal to everybody as a coworker. We were very busy clinically, as you well know, and we had to cross-cover one another at night. We had to cross-cover one another during the day in the ICU. And even though the group was not all lovey-dovey, we had to get along professionally. And it was really important for everybody in the group to have a say in who came in. I really was looking for highly energetic people who understood the hospital and wanted to be part of something that was clearly going to get better over time. We had one person who interviewed with us who had done trauma, but was mainly interested in advancing his laparoscopic career. And when the group met, we agreed his interests were not really in line with ours perfectly. A very good person. Interesting. I know what happened to him over his career. Probably would have been of great benefit to our group in terms of developing laparoscopy, but we were primarily interested at the time in acute care surgery and people who would, you know, make a run with us while the group was intact.
If we shift gears a little bit here, Dr. Feliciano, we sort of look at the concept of, especially for trainees, you know, selecting a fellowship. And I don't think I ever told you this, although maybe in the last 24 hours did. One of the, there's many reasons that you know, I came down to Grady to train with you guys, but one of the reasons, quite honestly, was I had spent a significant amount of time, almost 6 months in South Africa, and the volumes were similar, And my observation of how deeply and profoundly you and your faculty cared about the patients and were willing to go to any ends, no matter how described, to provide optimal care. You know, I remember you saying to me early, every patient's your brother, your mother, your father, your sister, and treat them as such. That was a huge reason why we showed up. And I think Lorraine and Neil would say the same sort of thing. So outside of things like that are obvious, like high volumes, what should a trainee be looking for a high-quality fellowship experience?
I think there are a couple things. One is you have to get a sense when you interview on whether the person who leads the group, whether it's a division chief or a hospital chief or whatever, is really committed to mentoring and supporting somebody's career. I've worked with several chairs, for example, where their goal was to continue their notoriety, but were very terrible mentors. And that doesn't help any young fellow or faculty person. So a strong leader who's clinically active, who will be supportive. Secondly, the vibrations in the group, is everybody on the same wavelength in terms of caring about the patients and committing themselves to always doing what's right, always getting up at the M&M and telling the truth in front of the fellows and residents. I think those were really the important things for somebody to consider when looking at a fellowship or a job. Is the group functioning well together? Are they committed to the same goals? Do they look like they will support a new person? Most of my choices for faculty were really good. Had a couple glitches along the way, and in retrospect, I had funny vibrations about the people who eventually turned out to be somewhat troublesome, and I always became much more sensitive to my inner vibrations with people rather than looking just at their CV. And that was part of the process of everybody in the group saying, is this somebody who I want covering my sick patient, who will cover me when I have to run home because my child is sick, who will come in and help me on a busy call night. Groups are really critical to academic development because the more smart people you put in a room, the better the abstracts and the studies and the papers and the presentations are going to be. A few individuals can do this alone, very bright, highly motivated people. But I think the thing about our group was that we were pretty much on the same wavelength. We all believed in the academic process, and we all pretty much wanted the other people to succeed, which is really critical.
Yeah, there's no question the academic productivity that had come out of Grady, you know, under obviously your leadership and also Dr. Rizicki's leadership was absolutely remarkable, and it just changed the field forever, over and over and over again. You did mention the term mentorship, and I realize mentorship and teaching are different, but certainly perhaps related. You won the teaching award, General Surgery Teaching Award at Emory University. I don't know how many years in a row. I remember it was absolutely ridiculous. You can remind us, but not so much how do you do that, but what advice do you have in particular for maybe junior faculty that are trying to get better at teaching and engage as mentors in their practice and in their careers?
Well, my wife's the expert on mentorship, having given a presidential address or two on it. The biggest thing about being a leader or a mentor from the mentor side is you've got to be willing to take the time to listen to the fellow or junior faculty and get a sense of their motivation, what their problems are, what problems they're confronting with any projects and all, and how they perceive how their own career is going. One of the things I learned early as a surgeon in chief at Grady was to keep my mouth shut when someone came in my office at a junior level and not try and respond to every point, but just listen and get a sense of if they were satisfied with the way things are going or not. And the other thing I learned was that when faculty come to you with problems and you're their mentor, you do not have to tell them in the first conversation that you're going to solve their problem. I learned very quickly not to make those promises and to say to people, let me think about it or let me talk to some other people and we'll get together in 2 weeks or something. Let's make an appointment now. I found that a much better way to mentor and supervise or whatever, because it gave me time to think out a good solution. And if I didn't have a solution, I would tell people 2 weeks later, I don't think we can solve this problem that you're having, but here are some options to maybe work around it. So good mentors listen, good mentors show interest in the production and advancement of their mentees. It's time consuming for the mentor. It's hard work sometimes. It can be frustrating. And particularly for someone like myself, who's not really a extroverted people person, it's a learning process. You certainly get better at it. My relationship with the fellows at the Shock Trauma Center in terms of mentoring is really good because I think I understand the process better. I can sympathize with the fellows as they're getting ready to take a job. I can sympathize with them in terms of the things they don't get during a fellowship in the modern era. But it is a process where you get better at it. But in the beginning, Chad, you have to be a believer in academics. And mentorship is, of course, one of those things that's part of it.
For sure. The natural next question then is, and you sort of bring it up there, is what sort of factors should go into the equation in evaluating and then selecting your first job out of the gate or out of fellowship?
Yeah, hard thing to do.
Yeah, for sure.
Basically, it's similar to what I mentioned previously. You should have a set of criteria that you think would be necessary for your first job. For example, if you have been in a fellowship where you had 85 or 90% blunt trauma and have never operated on a gunshot wound to the femoral artery, but you're really interested in that injury, then you probably should not go to a center that does 85 to 90% blunt trauma again. You should know yourself a bit as you finish your fellowship and say to yourself, these are the things I really enjoy doing. I love clinical high-end trauma surgery. I love writing papers. Well, therefore, am I going to a place that has mechanisms available to help you with data collection, data retrieval, statistics, editing? Thirdly, I think you need to see the salary progress. Do they go by AAMC guidelines? Do they go beyond that? Are there bonuses for night call? There's a whole list of things that I give fellows if they ask me on things to look for in your first job. But I think you do it logically. It's not a random, and certainly you should have some criteria, as I mentioned. And then finally, it'd be your inner vibration. Do I feel like I would fit in here? Or are there clearly several young faculty who are disgruntled and talking about leaving? That's not the kind of situation you want to go into.
That's superb advice. I mean, sometimes that can be hard to figure out, and sometimes certainly it's not hard to figure out. But due diligence is key. You've touched on a lot of the things maybe that surround the answer to the next question I'd ask you. But just to put it in a cohesive package, if you are starting out in your first year, second year, third year, what are your concrete advisements for either starting a clinical research program or even maybe more challenging, a laboratory research program? And I think it's certainly an increasingly relevant question, at least it is in Canada, because the funding mechanisms are poor, you know, our provincially led healthcare systems really don't more and more so care about research at all. All they care about is, you know, high quality clinical delivery. And that has a trickle-down effect, not only just because of the money, but also just the general environmental milieu that we experience up here.
I really just did a little bit of laboratory work early in my career, so I should not speak on it at all. But my advice would be in any decent academic center, And often in your same department, there are other people who are funded who have active labs. And it's often very helpful to join one of those labs first where they have PhDs to help the science. They have technicians to monitor the animals. They have, again, a mechanism to collect data, retrieve data, et cetera. I think to start a de novo lab as a new faculty is very, very difficult these days, particularly if you only have a starter grant from your own department. So I would, you know, consider joining with others. And some of my colleagues in academic surgery have been very effective in going to other departments in medical school when they have interests similar to, let's say, an immunologist or somebody like that. And that really helps getting involved with established people. Clinical studies, you need a certain number of criteria. You need the volume of the thing you're going to study. I always use the example, if the only trauma you get in your trauma center is traumatic brain injuries, then that's probably what you ought to study. And then again, instead of gunshot wounds, the aorta. I mean, it's not complicated. You study what you have. And then there's a series of components. Getting through the IRB is one of the big ones these days. Secondly, once you're approved, it's a question of whether you will have people to do the data collection, or as I did in Houston. And Gene Moore has done repeatedly in Denver. We had the residents fill out, you know, data sheets on certain injuries after they came out of the OR, and Gene used to have them put it in a mailbox or a slot in his door, and I would collect them in the morning report at Houston. So I had a continuing stream of data coming in, and you can, in these days, load it into a computer online. And then you should just, ask science questions, clinical science questions that are realistic. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. And the final thing is to have the support that I mentioned. Do you have a good track system where you have a registrar who can pull charts from this data later? Do you have somebody who can help you write? Do you have somebody who can help you get an abstract ready for submission? You'll hear this theme recurrently, that all these processes in an academic career are collaborative in some way. Many of my studies were incredibly simple, just comparing splenectomy versus splenic repair. You know, we had two groups. This is the mm-hmm. way they presented. This is what their associated injuries were. This was how bad the spleen was. I mean, I presented two papers at major meetings on splenic repair because, you know, we were doing it when I came to Bentown. We were doing 50 splenectomies a year. In 5 years, that's a couple hundred. It's incredible. So look at what you have. Get people to help you with the data collection, et cetera. And be collaborative in the study. Include your colleagues if they're, you know, submitting patients for the study.
You know, we've all learned so very much from you, but there was sort of three things that I think that you profoundly drove home in myself and a lot of us that have come through there. And the first thing is, as you point out, asking that simple question. Your questions and your publications are always extremely clear, extremely focused and extremely direct. And I think that's something that our brains tend to overlook, and we try and overcomplicate it sometimes when the basics aren't answered. The second thing that was really helpful, at least for me at the time, was I would come to you and I'd say, I have this idea, I want to look at A versus B, what do you think? And I don't know if you remember or not at this point, but you would say, well, that's a great question, Chad. And then you would proceed to tell me how it fit into the last 100 years of history of that question or that concept or that area of surgery. And that in itself is something I don't see around a lot, a complete command of the literature, so that I'm not spinning my wheels and I am trying to produce some sort of paper that contributes to moving the field forward. So I think finding, you know, that one or two or three people maybe in your department that has that historical understanding is amazing. The third thing was, you know, and I hope maybe you can comment on it, is the actual process itself. So, you know, the contemplation and the conception is one thing, but in terms of sitting down and writing an abstract and then targeting a particular meeting and then writing that abstract, editing that, as I should say, writing that manuscript, editing that manuscript, and submitting that manuscript to a given journal. What, do you have any thoughts you can share about that sort of more definitive end process?
You really get better at the process, like everything I've mentioned previously, meaning when I first started writing abstracts, I would put in conclusions that really weren't justified by the data, or I'd make gratuitous, superfluous comments in the conclusions when, again, the data just didn't support it. I think when you first start, go to the program book of the society that you're submitting the abstract to and look at the abstracts in the previous year or two. And you'll see, you'll gain a lot of wisdom from seeing how people are able to condense their thoughts, not put in too much data, and then draw a limited number of conclusions from the available data. And then, honestly, I was pretty careful at Grady about reviewing almost all abstracts that went out to major meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I know that offended some people, but, you know, I'd done it for a long time. I'd been on program committees. I've been a program chair for several societies, and I just sort of had a sense of when things were just unclear or unreadable. When you write an abstract or a paper, I think it's really important to write an outline ahead of time for both. Like, what exactly, why did we do this study? What was the main hypothesis? Secondly, just list the methods, if they were retrospective or concurrent, or just say it and don't apologize for it. It is what it is. And then some people put so much results in abstracts or in papers that it overwhelms the reader. And I certainly in the abstract, it ought to be very, very limited. But then finally, they need to correlate to the conclusions that are drawn. I don't think an abstract should state more than one or two significant conclusions. When you write papers, after you get the outline, you know, then it's honestly a matter of doing it over and over and over again. Ask any academic surgeon about a paper he or she wrote, you know, 30 or 35 years ago and compared to their most recent published paper, and they'll all notice a change in the style of writing. It's much more direct. It's clearer. Conclusions are probably better justified. One of the things I learned at Baylor when I was a young faculty was I got to know Dr. DeBakey's sisters, Lois and Selma, who edited all of his publications. And Lois was a bit crusty, but she took an interest in me because I took an interest in her. And one of the things she said to me early in my career was, write like you speak, meaning many surgeons really write in a flowery fashion when they have an abstract or a paper accepted to a meeting. And the first thing I always do is, if I'm editing, is take out all the flowers and just boom, boom, boom. This is a scientific paper. People's time is limited, and you want to get your, you know, your points across in a relatively rapid and clear fashion. So I go through a lot of edits for chapters and papers. I've had chapters where I've done 18 drafts. I just couldn't get it right, and I kept moving paragraphs and changing words. And if you're not willing to commit, you're not going to get things accepted and published, because people will not be able to get your ideas if you're a bad writer.
Yeah, there's no doubt. That's so true. I think we all know you're editing Red Pen well, and we all appreciate it both at the time, but even more so as time goes on.
Well, some people appreciate it. Far from all.
I don't know. I think most. Now, I know you didn't want me to ask this, but I'm going to make the comment and ask you anyway, because everybody you've trained us essentially has been telling me to ask you, which is the statement is you are a technically gifted surgeon, full stop, non-discussable, non-negotiable, and I think the world knows that. The question then is whether you start that way, which is probably very few, or whether you get good to that level or close to that level, how do you get better clinically as you go through your career? And I don't know if you think about it in terms of junior, mid-career, senior, or how you think about it, but we're all curious how you put that together. How do you get better on the clinical side?
Well, just to be frank, I was very average when I finished my training at the Mayo Clinic. It was a different kind of residency in those days, and a lot of complicated stuff that the faculty did a lot of. So I was considered average. I'd be in the great middle of the bar graft. I did recognize that when I went to Baylor, where the residents were very technically gifted, many of them, because they had this huge set of hospitals where they operated, the County Hospital Ben Taub, Private Hospital Methodist, the VA, a children's hospital, another private hospital. And what I did, and this sounds crazy now, but I told my wife at the time that I was going to sleep in the hospital as a new attending and take call with my team at the county hospital every third night. I mean, no one told me I had to do that. No one paid me. But I slept in every third night on my own without getting paid for about 6 months and just watched and assisted the chief residents at Baylor College of Medicine. And I learned so much, both good and bad. Mm-hmm. The second thing I think that really helped was there was a tendency many years ago for faculty not to cover all cases in public hospitals, as I mentioned before. But I really love operating like most surgeons, and I just found that if my team was going to do a toe amputation, for example, and the chief resident really wasn't interested because he or she was going to cardiac surgery, I would happily scrub with the intern. And I still do it at shock trauma. I mean, I just do. You just keep operating every day. There's some academic surgeons who are so busy traveling and lecturing, writing grants, whatever, that they end up doing 100 cases a year or something, the usual two cases a week. You will not get better at that volume. So almost every year in academics, despite the other activities, I made sure I did about 350 to 400 cases, which is 8 cases a week. It really helped me get better and better because I operated on everything as we used to in those days, the general surgery cases, the vascular cases, thoracic for trauma, endocrine. If you do a broad base and maintain a high volume, you just get better technically and you get smarter in terms of your intraoperative decision making. The other thing I've done is, and this isn't done much anymore, but I used to go watch people operate. I used to go back to the Mayo Clinic about every year or so and pick one of the surgeons there. It was usually John Van Heerden, who I had tremendous respect for as an endocrine surgeon. I would just stand behind John every other day, the Mayo Clinic way of operating, and just watch him do cases all day and ask him questions and take notes. I went to MD Anderson within the past 4 years to learn how to do a retroperitoneal adrenalectomy. One of my fellow Mayo trainees is chief of endocrine surgery there. I called her. I just went down, spent my own money, and watched her do cases. And I've done that all over the country. There are people I wanted to watch where I never got there, but I'd really recommend that. And then the third and fourth thing is don't be afraid to talk to people in your own institution. If you want to learn how to do open peripheral vascular or an open thoracotomy, then go talk to your local vascular thoracic surgeon, say, you know, I've got a slow week coming up next. Would you mind if I sat in or scrubbed in or whatever, observed you on any open cases that you do? So I've been watching surgeons my whole career, and you get a sense of, I can learn something from this person, or you can't. So it's a multi-step process, including all the things that I mentioned. But the big ones are get volume, stay with it. Don't abdicate the OR to advance yourself academically.
Oh, man, that's such great advice. You know, it also requires humility, and it requires persistence. And yeah, that's amazing. One of the last questions I want to ask you, boss, is you've always said to me time and time again that you should reevaluate your own career in a very honest way, maybe every 5 years or so, and whether that's setting new goals or reassessing your immediate environment, just figuring out how to move forward. Can you talk about that for the benefit of our listeners and what you really meant?
When you start your career, there's probably a small subset of people who really have an idea that, you know, I want to be a chairman, or I want to be the highest billing surgeon in whatever department I'm in or whatever. But most of us have to be in a place for a couple of years to see, for example, what the case mix is, how referrals occur, what comes in on night call. But in the end, you want to find what really is a passion, what really gets you excited in the OR and outside the OR, those two things. I mean, some people are terrible teachers and other people are gifted teachers. Some people are great leaders and other people are not. And at some point in your first year or two, you ought to sit down with yourself at a desk and say, these are the two or three things I want to accomplish in the next 5 years, meaning I will need 40 to 50 publications to get promoted to associate professor. Okay, how do I get there? How many papers is that a year? What topics am I going to write on? Who am I going to have help me? Or I want to be the greatest teacher ever in the history of the med school. Let me go talk to the person who runs the student program. Let me talk to the program director for general surgery. Where can I get involved in teaching? It's sort of like a business decision. You've made a choice on what you think are the things that really get you excited. Now, the next step while you're sitting at your desk is, what are the 3 or 4 or 10 steps you have to take to get to that goal? Many people find if they're in a trauma career that after the age of 40, it gets very difficult. You don't recover as quickly if you've been up at night. A lot of the patients are so sick in this era of geriatric trauma that it's not always enjoyable. And some people feel that when they have one of these conversations with themselves, they want to branch out and say, I'm going to start moving toward becoming a leader in an academic department or in my med school or in one of the surgical societies. And it's the same process. How do I get there? And you just have to be prepared that it's like life. You're not going to get everything you want out of an academic career. But with hard work and planning and good mentorship, you're going to get a lot of what you desire. But reevaluation at least every 5 years is critical. And if you have to change paths, yeah, change paths. It's just like life. It's not a crisis.
I have two questions for you. One is, when did you sleep? And the second question is, you know, as someone who really has a command, as Dr. Ball said, of the history of trauma over the last, you know, however many years, where do you really see trauma care going in the future? And what do you see as the big challenges for trauma care for my generation?
I think this is an individual thing, but I'm a napper. There isn't a Saturday or Sunday that went by when I was active and practiced that I didn't take some naps. I learned that from my father, by the way. In terms of the history, it really helps when you're writing papers or even planning studies or giving presentations to have a sense of where we all came from as surgeons, particularly in trauma. And the history is, you know, unfortunately goes back about 2,000 years if you've done some reading. But I will encourage people to do the reading from history books. I've got, you know, Major's history book of all the first descriptions of medical diseases. I have any number of surgical books from the 40s and 50s reviewing the history of surgery up to that time. The materials out there for Christmas, I gave three of my colleagues around the country, one outside shock trauma and two inside, a book on the history of vascular trauma from a resident at Duke who was kind enough to send it to me. So, I mean, the material is out there. It's just a matter of, instead of watching another episode of something on television, it's just picking up a book and committing yourself to 15 to 30 to 60 minutes a night when you're not tired, and just learning about these things, annotating in the margin, taking some notes, so that when you go to write something, you have this material available and you're very familiar with it. I'm very disappointed in the journals that now say we don't want any references before the year 2000. I'm particularly sensitive about that because it's about 60% of my CV. And so, you know, everything I wrote is disappearing. But biggest challenges in trauma care, I think with the availability of acute care surgery for people in trauma, a lot of our concerns about recruiting our successors have been alleviated, frankly. Now it's a question of getting people to tackle the questions that we have never been able to answer, right? Like, simple question, when do you do a fasciotomy? You know, we can't answer that. Whether you're talking about a therapeutic or a prophylactic fasciotomy, we know there's a lot of individual variability in how people tolerate a high compartment pressure. That just absolutely speaks to the need for a prospective study in many centers. Should you anticoagulate after you put in a PTFE graft for trauma? I have no idea. I know what I do, but we need to study that. There are a bunch of people going around saying you don't need to use heparin while you're doing a peripheral vascular repair. Oh, really? How do they know that? Well, they did some retrospective data collection and wrote a terrible paper. So I think there are a lot of questions that should keep people interested and active for many years to come. And I would encourage people to pick one of those questions early in their career and say, I'm going to spend the next 30 years studying, operating, and writing about this topic. For example, you'll never see my name as a first author on a paper about colon injuries. Why? I can't explain it, but I don't have that great an interest. So my partners have always written, I've picked areas that are really of interest to me, like vascular trauma. I think trauma and acute care has a pretty bright future. Keeping people in the profession as they get older requires a division or a chair to allow people to make some adaptations to the physical constraints and things like that. But right now, as long as we have men and testosterone and alcohol, trauma will not go away in the United States.
I just want to end by asking a very, I think, simple question that we ask a lot of the guests, which is very simply, thinking back over, in your case, an extraordinary, long, productive, and amazing career, what advice would you give trainees, or what advice would you have wished you have gotten earlier that maybe you didn't?
I didn't recognize early on how important the, if you will, the old boys network was in controlling a lot of academic activities outside the medical school, meaning getting into societies, joining committees in societies, getting to present at the college, presenting at major meetings, being asked to write chapters. There is a network of people in each specialty that, in a way, control many of the activities. And it took me a little while, again, with an introverted personality, but I did learn to go up to people at meetings and say, you know, I really admire your work, and I just have a few questions. And by doing that, you know, I got to meet some really great people from all over the world, and I got some really great advice. And then they knew my name and that I was interested in their field. So I would not be bashful. I tell fellows this all the time. They never listen. But if you see Gene Moore at a meeting and you have some issue, or, you know, academic or career-wise or whatever, he can find the time. You just have to approach a person like that appropriately and say what I said. I met Leon Pachter at New York University on a tennis court. And I went up to him and I said, I have read all your papers. And I said, I just love them. And he is now, you know, all these years later, it's 38 years later, we're close friends. And that kind of contact really helps you. So a big one is branch out, make good contacts in your field. It'll be mutually beneficial over time. And the second thing really is, you know, find your passions if you can early and really commit to them, as I mentioned previously. And you'll get better at writing about them, studying them, or even operating on them. You can't be a rubber ball in academics. Some people are, but you want to have a few things that are really true to you that you're interested in, and pursue those.
You've been listening to Cold Steel, the official podcast of the Canadian Journal of Surgery. If you've liked what you've been listening to, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear your comments and feedback, so feel free to email us at podcast.cjs@gmail.com or connect with us on Twitter @CanJSurge. Thanks again.